My name's Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document.
As a child, our next guest spent her summer holidays providing aid to those in need. She also experienced a string of traumatic events, which culminated in her developing chronic fatigue syndrome. Since then, she has dedicated her working life to supporting members of the armed forces, and her story of personal growth and development is an inspiration to us all. A people special, Helen Helliwell. This is Declassified. Where was you born?
I was born in Yeovil in Somerset.
Mm. What was your mum and dad do?
Dad, he was an engineer at Westlands, which I think is now Finn Mechanica, isn't it? He was an engineer on the H101. And my mum was worked part-time as clerk of the local parish council, quite a small village, growing a lot now. But we also had a farm with, pigs and chickens and cows and sheep and ducks. And so mum and dad managed that as well.
Was it a small holding or was it like a proper farm?
Yeah, well, no, it was a small holding. We didn't like work the fields or anything. We grew cider apples and made cider and did all the animal side of it. But yeah
was it a feral?
Yeah, it was great because we were just outside all day, really. I remember they converted one of the pigsties into a den for us. And we just used to be out playing in the little stream and playing in the orchard. And yeah, it was great, fantastic fun.
Who is this, you and who else?
I've got an older sister and a younger brother.
Okay. What was the relationship like growing up?
Brilliant, actually. Yeah, really good. We all just met up last weekend, actually, for the first time. It's brilliant. It's like you can pick up the conversation where you last left it.
Very friendly.
Yeah.
And with regards, because obviously, busy kind of childhood, busy parents.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it. Anyway.
Yeah.
Was you always like together as family, eating together?
Always had meals together in the evening, always had a Sunday roast on a Sunday, always went out for a walk afterwards, spent a couple of weeks in a caravan every summer in the south of France usually, so pretty traditional in that respect.
Yeah, but plenty of time outside.
Yeah, always.
Yeah, very active.
Yeah, didn't watch the TV hardly at all growing up, and we didn't have a computer or anything, but it was a long time ago.
Well, come on. Not that long ago. But with regards to kind of schooling.
Yeah. I went to the local primary school. It was tiny, about 50 pupils. And then I went to the local state school, which is a bit bigger. But kind of 15 minutes down the road type thing.
Yeah. And what kind of, I'm just trying to get the picture of, because it sounds idyllic. What was it? Detached house? Was it like?
It was a farmhouse.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Several hundred years old. So fireplaces in every room, including our bedrooms. Didn't have central heating to quite late in the day.
Yeah.
Big arga in the kitchen, cellar, that kind of thing. Yeah. Very old country farmhouse, really.
Yeah. Were you scared of much as a kid? Like, was there rats and mice on the
farm? Yeah, I was a bit because somebody had died in the house, like this old chap had fallen through the roof and died, and we always thought there was a ghost in the house. But no, it was really lovely. I actually, funny enough, took my kids back there last weekend and showed Rosie, and my favourite climbing tree was still in the garden. I was like, yeah, some things don't change. All the barns have been converted into houses now, so that's a bit of a shame, but the farmhouse itself and its garden and stuff is still there.
No pigs still there?
No, all the animals have gone because they put houses there instead.
Yeah, well, that's the times we live in. The times we live in. Houses are worth more than pigs. And then I suppose, so were you close to your mum and dad?
Yes. Yeah, very close.
And you had a good relationship?
Yep.
And, I mean, well, I'm going to fast forward a little bit. Because you've got two little ones now.
Yes, yeah.
And I suppose, is parenting then, has that impacted you now with regards
close to mine, really open with them, probably talk to them far too much than I should do about world events and stuff, but they're really interested in it and I don't shy away from talking about it with them. They are 7 and 9.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the reasons I mention it with a previous conversation we've had, and it was a very traumatic experience when you was 7.
Yeah.
And this is probably one of the first times you've openly talked about it. And can you kind of give us a kind of overview?
I think everybody, has traumatic events in their childhood, which probably shaped the way they are. Mine was a supposedly friend of the family who abused me it was, I knew, over a very short period of time, because I told my sister about it, who then told my mum, and obviously had a chat with my mum and never had to see the person again. But I think it was much later, kind of when I was a teenager and onwards, that it really affected me, just in terms of your self-esteem. And but you learn coping mechanisms, and you learn resilience, and you learn to manage it.
Yeah. I've jumped us to that point quite quickly in this conversation, and I've done it for a reason. We've just spoke at length before we came on, and it's the growth and the development that we want to speak about a little bit later on with it. Need to say, it was a horrendous kind of brief period of time, and the importance of being open with the kids.
Yes.
With my parents
who believed me and sorted that out quickly.
Can you explain, like, what, not what happened, but the kind of post that? I think it's really, really vital and a skill that parents can take on, especially myself. Like, I've learned a lot.
Well, I suppose I talked to my sister, who's 4 years older than me, who immediately told mum. And then I remember mum sitting down and talking to me about it and, you know, saying how sorry she was and all that kind of stuff. But I think it was later when you realised the impact of what happened.
Mm.
But as I said, you learn to manage it, if not ever get over it.
Mm. You was loved and supported from your mum.
Yeah, it was difficult because the person who had the relationship with him kept having that relationship, so all the rest of the family shunned him. But the person who had the relationship kept it, so whenever I went to visit her, there'd be photos of him on the wall or his clothes in the wardrobe kind of stuff. So that was difficult, but I never had to see him again.
Yeah. Did your dad handle it well?
I never talked to Dad about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But he'd have known.
Yes. So Mum said, I'm going to have to tell Dad about this. I think they just felt really upset.
Yeah.
That it had happened.
I think it's testament to your parents that was that open kind of line of communication.
Yeah, absolutely.
And spending time with kids, whether it's around the table or discussing kind of social events or personal events.
And that not everybody's nice, and you need to call it out if something happens that you're not comfortable with. And, you know, there's such a stigma about this kind of thing, but the more you talk about it, the more you realise how common it is.
Yeah.
I don't want to, you know, I don't know the stats, but I do know that when I've talked about it, people said, oh yeah, that happened to me, boys and girls. And I'm just like, crikey, it's not uncommon.
I think it's surprisingly common.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I think it's important to kind of bust the stigma a bit.
Yeah. Did you, when was the first time you spoke about it as an adult? I'll tell you what, let me rephrase that. Off the back of that kind of event, did you feel like you were stronger with your siblings and with your parents? I'm moving forward several years now.
Yeah, I've not talked to my brother about it because he was so much younger. But to my sister, yes, definitely, and to mum.
You used to, like I say, we were tight as a family. You used to do what families do, holiday and do everything else. And again, like this conversation, we're going to try and cram quite a lot into such a short space of time. And I think it's really relevant we jump us to, was it the holiday in Jamaica?
Yeah. So the Africa stuff was...
Oh, sorry, yeah.
The Africa. So
yeah, let's go to Africa first.
A few years after that incident, my parents unfortunately divorced, but still really close with both of them. So unfortunately, we had to get rid of their farm and their animals and all that kind of stuff. So that was a tricky transition. And then my mum and stepdad got really involved in this charity in West Africa. It was mainly to supply local clinics and local schools with really basic materials. So we used to, loads of donations would come to our house. We used to store them in the barn. It would be like medical supplies, everything random from a wheelchair to a pair of crutches to bandages to a blood pressure machine, just stethoscopes. And then on the school side, it'd be writing equipment, textbooks, all that kind of stuff. And then when we got enough to send off in a container, we used to do that. And then we used to spend 2 to 3 weeks every year out in Africa. Used to hire a 4x4 and just go deep into these really remote places. Staying in the compound where we were donating the stuff to see how it's being used, and you know, making sure that nothing had batteries in it because they can't replace batteries, not using felt tips because they dry out and they don't know how to put the lid on. It was real basic stuff, but, you know, really eye-opening for me. I suppose this happened between 12 and 15, 16, or 11, 12, over a few years period. And we used to stay in the compound with the villagers. The kids often slept outside, but we were allowed to sleep with a hammock or a mat on the floor. There was no kind of running water or electricity. And I was always amazed by the massive welcome we got and the amazing food when they've got no facilities. It was just beautiful. And when we did stay in hotels, they were the type that you rent by the hour, not by the night. And they were really quite grim. One stuck out as being really grim to the extent that my sister and I pitched our tent in the hotel room to get away from all the creepy corners and dirty bed sheets and stuff. But I think that really taught me about another way of life I'd never been exposed to. And a lot of the kids that we met out there had not really spent any time with white people before. So me and my sister both having long blonde hair, they were always touching our hair because it's so different to them. But just, you know, seeing these kids who'd walk for hours to get to a school when all that school had was just like a room. There was no chairs, no tables, no textbooks, no writing material. But they're so passionate about getting an education. That was really formative, I think, to me.
What was the initial link then? How did that...
They went there on holiday. We were really taken by the country. Their taxi driver from the airport to the resort was like, oh, it's my daughter's christening today. Do you want to come? And they were like, yeah. So they just went off. Instead of going to the resort, they just went off to this taxi driver's christening. And from there, they just fell in love with the country. So we kept going back. And then they got involved with the charity.
Where was it again?
Gambia.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
And... Sorry, go on, Karen.
Yeah, so that's where their interest, it sparked from that holiday. I mean, this was years ago, so obviously it's quite developed since then. But at the time, the hotel industry hadn't really taken off. There was only a couple of hotels. But then we moved away. It was only that one holiday. All the rest of the time was, going around these really remote villages. It was just a completely different experience. You go on a bus and you're on the bus with a goat and a chicken and there's people hanging out the window and stuff. It's just things that I hadn't experienced before, but it makes you a lot less materialistic. You see the kids playing with a stick and a can or elastic bands wrapped up into a football and stuff. They really learn how to be inventive, and two-year-olds, you know, getting stuck in with the jobs around the camp and stuff. It was just really a fantastic experience.
Oh, it's travel and...
Yeah, really broadens the mind,
doesn't it? Yeah, it really does. And I think that's a prime example of how what could be perceived as being negative or like run down, whatever you want to call it, and then being so impacted with it in a positive way and understand your ability to be able to, again, positively impact that community. Was it uncharacteristic then of your mum, I suppose, to kind of do that?
Like, no,
it
she was quite
really
a,
adventurous.
Just no, to... she's quite a hippie person like that, I think.
See?
And then, I was lucky to do travel with mum and dad in different, obviously different holidays. And then I suppose after that is when we went to Jamaica.
Yeah.
And we were... it was our second, third night there, and we were walking from the hotel to a restaurant as a family, and we were robbed at gun and knife point. So one guy had a gun, the other had a knife, and he was asking mum for a handbag. She's like, no, I'm not giving it to you, no. And we're like, mum, he's got a gun. And he kind of caught the gun and put it in my stepdad's stomach, and she gave him the handbag. And then he asked for all her rings, but because it was hot, her fingers had swollen up and she couldn't get her rings off her fingers. And he was just like, well, I'm just going to cut your fingers off then. He had quite a big blooming knife, so it felt quite violent. But she managed to get her rings off and they ran away. We went back up to the hotel. He seemed a bit nonplussed, the receptionist, to be honest, if this was like an everyday occurrence. But anyway, he phoned the police. And as the police were on our way to us, they'd obviously spotted this guy with a white handbag, so looking slightly out of place, and a gun sticking out of his pocket, or this is what they said. So the police apprehended him. Apparently the robber turned his gun on the police. The police shot him, shot the gun out of his hand. He lost three of his fingers. And we kind of got a phone call saying, we think we've caught him. And we were like amazed. So we were kind of blue lighted up through downtown Kingston to the police station there, which was another kind of experience, I guess, and asked to identify the chap. And, I felt quite sorry for him when I saw him. He'd obviously had some kind of big bruising around his face, like he'd been punched a bit, and his hand was also completely mangled. And they just gave us the white handbag back with all the blood on it. It was quite surreal, really. And then we had to go to court a couple of days later. We saw the trial, which was another kind of experience in a Jamaican court. He got sentenced to 3.5 years But I suppose the way it affected me is that they only caught one of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, really, whilst you know that it couldn't happen, I just felt that the other person would always try and come and get us to kind of seek revenge.
Had you always felt safe in Africa?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
Because year after year, you go in, you're experiencing different things. And
yeah.
Then we say about... Did you get... I kind of almost know the answer because you just half said it. But then did you get fearful?
Yes, I got really...
You're about 15.
Yes, I was really, really scared. Scared to be on my own. Just even like going into a room, I had to know that nobody was in there, check cupboards, all that kind of stuff. And I used to run a lot at that stage over the Somerset levels. And I always used to be looking over my shoulder. Or if I ran past a barn or something, I'd think, Christ, is he in there? It was just completely illogical to think that somebody would travel all the way to Jamaica to come and get you, but it's just how I felt.
The experience itself, was it vivid? Did you dream about it after?
Yes.
Did you remember
it a
lot after?
Yeah.
You can take a moment. It's fine, you're right.
Yeah.
It's
I haven't talked about it for years and years, so I think it's first time that you talk about it, you just get a bit more mush.
It does, isn't it? And it's recorded, and there's two mics, but it's all safe. We'll take this out as well. The we mentioned nightmares.
Yeah.
Was you sleeping well?
I can't really recollect, but I do remember having a lot of nightmares. And I don't know if that contributed to then what happened next.
Explain what happened next.
So I was always really, really sporty. And I knew that I was, and we had sports day coming up. I knew I was going to set some records in like the 300, 200, 100 metres. I'd already set records in the cross country a few weeks previously. But on the Friday of sports day, I'd been off school all week. I had the flu and I felt really awful. So I said on the Friday that I'd just go in to watch my mates and I'd take my PE kit in as a spare. But obviously I got changed and got ready to compete. But I just felt really ill and, you know, in a way that I hadn't ever done before. Anyway, got to the relay race and my team, because obviously you run for your house and collect points, and I hadn't collected the points from winning any of the other races. So my team were like, look, if you can just do the relay, it's only a 4x1. I always did the last leg, and I was like, right, okay, I'll do it. And, you know, it's that kind of stuff of dreams, isn't it? When you get handed the bat and you're in fifth place, you whiz past everybody and you win the race, which I did. So that felt good. But then later that evening, I collapsed and was taken to hospital. They thought I had meningitis, but I didn't. And actually, I think I got far worse after I left hospital. So I was in hospital for a few days. I had pneumonia and glandular fever. And then I think afterwards is when the diagnosis came of post-viral fatigue syndrome, or ME. It was quite unclear at that time. This is, you know, a few decades ago now. And I was just really ill for many months, really. You know, I didn't get out of bed for probably... Well, it felt, yeah, it was, I was just exhausted. It was a really bizarre situation, having been so sporty and so musical. I used to play the piano and clarinet and stuff. And, you know, I couldn't even lift up the kettle to make a cup of tea because the kettle was so heavy. I remember having to crawl to just get to the bathroom because I couldn't walk very far. And it's not as though I could lie in bed and watch TV, because it would just give me these massive headaches. And I kind of just felt sick all the time. And just like trying to eat, the fork just felt so heavy. It just brought me out in sweats. It was just nothing like I'd ever experienced before. And that went on. The worst stage was at least 6-9 months, I think. And then I was having massages and physio at the house, which I think helped. It's hard to know what the turning point was. I think it was just a real gradual, but you really get to know your body. You really get to know what's going to push it beyond, because obviously you want to get better and your friends come round and talk, but you're just exhausted after half an hour of talking, and then it kind of sets you back a few days because you're just bedbound again. So I think that kind of testing, adjusting and listening to your body and understanding what your body's telling you is really important. It's probably been a lesson that's taken me through the rest of my time. Anyway, obviously I couldn't go to school for that whole year, but I had home tuition, which got me through a couple of the GCSEs because it was my GCSE year. And then I had, you know, not repeated a year because I didn't do the year in the first place, but went back to school and finished the rest of my GCSEs. I'd always wanted to be a doctor right from the age of 10, so I needed really good GCSEs. You know, I was a huge fan of doctors-to-be. I was subscribing to the Student British Medical Journal from the age of 12. It's all I'd ever focused on. So I did my A-levels, biology, chemistry, maths, really struggled with chemistry. I got some private tuition in those modules. I remember getting an A and a B, but with my other teacher, I got something like a D and an N. So anyway, I had a place to study at UCL, to study medicine at UCL, right around the corner from here. But my C in chemistry meant that I couldn't. But I didn't give up. I went through clearing. I studied physiology and pharmacology at Southampton. Absolutely loved Southampton. Can't say I enjoyed the pharmacology. I don't know why I chose it, having been so weak at chemistry. But I thought it would be a pathway into medicine. So I applied again to do medicine after that 3-year degree and got a place at Cardiff to study for another 5 years. And then I was something like 2% off getting the grades that I needed. Which was probably a good thing in a way, from what's happened. I looked at studying in Canada and stuff as well, but by then I'd racked up some student debt.
Just before we move on too far,
yeah.
Did you go back to the ME?
Yep.
Did you feel disabled?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I had to use a wheelchair for a bit. And just trying to get around in a wheelchair really exposes you to how difficult that is, where you can't get access to places because they're just not wheelchair friendly. I think we've made leaps and bounds, but I know from having a wheelchair user in my team now, just, you know, getting around London on the tube and stuff is just so difficult. So yeah, I did feel really disabled, and I felt a real burden on my family because I couldn't do much.
Did that have an impact then? Did you? You know, you mentioned being a burden or feeling like you've been a burden. I'm sure you wasn't. Did that have an impact on your mum, your stepdad, brother, sister?
Yeah.
Do you ever speak about it to them now?
No.
I mean, I know it's shaped you and how your mindset is now. And there's so much in this first part of this conversation that, I mean, has shaped you. But going into the education side of things, were you more determined then because of this kind of 6-9 month?
Yeah, maybe. Gap? I think it interested how the body worked and how it cannot work. Yeah. Just really interest me. But I always think that I'm a people person. So for me, I always wanted to be a GP because I thought that would expose me to the greatest cohort of people.
Yeah.
So it probably did without realising.
And then, so what happened then with the education?
So after Cardiff, after I didn't get into Cardiff, I went to my first graduate recruitment fair. I'd always thought about joining the armed forces, but I'm rubbish at discipline, rubbish at taking orders, don't like hierarchy. So, and also I knew that I wanted kids and I didn't want to be away for 6 months, you know, amazing credit and, you know, to people that can and juggle it really successfully, because thousands do, but I just didn't think that I could. And then I saw the brochure for the Fast Stream, which is like a graduate recruitment scheme into the civil service. I'd never heard of the civil service, to be honest, before that graduate recruitment fair. And then I saw this glossy one that was all about defence civil service on the Fast Stream. And it had pictures of people in helicopters, on boats, outside number 10, doing, and you know, the things that they said that they were doing in this brochure just sounded amazing. So I was like, okay, I'm going to apply for this, and threw everything into it. And on the application form at the time, you had to stipulate 3 government departments that you wanted to do in priority order. And I just put defence. I was like, I want to do defence, or I'm not, you know, I'll go find something else to do. So there's quite a lot of tests and it's quite a big procedure to get into the Fast Stream. It's quite competitive, and needless to say, I got to the very end of the selection but didn't quite pass it. But I was a near miss, so MOD phoned me up and said, look, we want you to come in anyway.
Yeah.
Coming as, it's called a direct entrant. You come in as a band D, which is an executive officer, kind of, you know, lowest rate.
How does it work with it? So what is the civil service?
Weird, isn't it? It's a weird equivalence, though. I think band D is equivalent to a captain. And then the next one up is equivalent to a major, then a half colonel, then a colonel.
Right, okay. So there is a crossover.
Yeah, there is a crossover, but it's not as though with my rank, I could go and do what the military do in theatre. Yeah, yeah. It's just really a crossover for when you're working in office spaces in England, I'd say.
So people figure it out.
Yeah, or more for kind of TNS expenses of what you're allowed, rather than any kind of anything a bit more meaningful.
Yeah. So you got in.
So I got in, and they told me I got in. So I moved to London, shared a one room in this house. I was the only English speaking person in the house. So that was another kind of culture change for me coming from my where I did. But it took 6 months to get my security clearance. But luckily all that time I was working with the British Nursing Association, as I did throughout college and university at weekends, summer holidays, which was a huge, it was fantastic. So I got to work in hospitals. I talked about the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital in Stanmore, where I worked with people who mostly had RTAs or motorbike accidents, but who had spinal injuries, really significant spinal injuries. So I was in the ward working with them.
What was you doing?
It's basic healthcare. So I was healthcare assistant. So it might be helping them feed, helping them wash, helping them get dressed, taking observations, taking blood pressures, breathing rates, that kind of stuff.
I mean, you could, you could empathise then?
Yes. Yes. And I also worked, I did quite a lot of work, psychiatric work as well. So when I was at Southampton, I worked for the Priory Group there. I don't know if you call it this now, but I worked in a facility for the criminally insane, kind of padded cell type stuff, whereas I was basically on suicide watch, making sure people didn't commit suicide. So I was either on one-to-one care with somebody, I don't know, playing cards, playing Monopoly, just talking to them.
Like a badass.
Yeah. And I remember this one woman I was playing Monopoly with, and I let her win, and I went to write her notes up, and I was like, well, what, you know, why is she in here? And it's because she'd stabbed her uncle to death and hidden him onto the staircase. And they'd only found the body because they had this big party and drugs were involved and stuff. And I was like, my God, I'm glad I would let her win at Monopoly. You know, you are really working with some troubled people, but, you know. And then I remember doing a placement in a house for one chap was deaf, the other was blind, the other was deaf and blind. And I'd not really worked with that cohort a lot before. And something had kicked off during the day. And I was supposed to just do the night shift. It was really short notice. So I quickly read up on my braille and how to sign on people's hands and stuff. And I got to the house and they'd set fire alarms off in the town. I think the deaf guy liked to press a button and see all this movement of people coming out of shops and stuff. And when I got there, the TV had been ripped off the wall, the fridge had been thrown across the room. And I was just like, it's the first time that I just said, look, I'm happy to stay, but I don't feel safe doing this by myself, because I didn't have the skills to communicate with them. I didn't have the tools and techniques. So, you know, the association were very supportive and sent somebody out.
And this was in Southampton.
One was back in Somerset when I was on a break from uni.
But all the way through.
So I did it in London, I did it in Southampton, and I did it in Somerset. It's a national agency, so you can just pick up work wherever you are, which was fantastic. You can do as many shifts or as least as you like.
What was your first role in the MOD?
My first role in the MOD was working on the Freedom of Information Act. I got the call about it on the day of the Twin Towers, and I thought, that's what I'm going to be doing. It's, you know, MOD call. And I was like, great. They're like, security clearance free was three. But no, Freedom of Information, which was actually much better than I thought it was going to be. It made me get out across the whole defence estate, work with all three services. And my line manager was incredibly supportive. There was a Fashing cohort that obviously I wasn't on, but I tried to mirror all of their courses and everything that they were doing. And she was really supportive of that. And where it was Fastream only, you know, they let me have their textbooks and manual books and stuff. So I used to read all their course notes. And part of it was spending a week abroad with or a week with one of the services. So I flew to Lisbon and joined HMS Grimsby, mine countermeasure vessel, and sailed back through the Bay of Biscay into Portsmouth with it, which was an amazing experience. We came through quite a big gale, so buckets were tied around each side of the ship, and all duties were kind of non-critical duties were suspended. I couldn't believe how many people were seasick. I was like, why do you join the Navy if you're seasick? But that was such a brilliant experience. Brilliant experience. And I literally, I got back and within the next week, I was I joined the Royal Navy Reserves. I was based at HMS President. Went to Raleigh, did my basic training, had an amazing time. And they said, you know, passed out really well, and they said you've got to go and do your officer training, but I really wanted to join the medical branch, and the training in the medical branch was brilliant, and you couldn't join as an officer unless you were a nurse, a doctor, a dentist. So it was more important for me to get the medical training, so I stayed as a junior rating for a few years.
And what did you pick up then in those couple of years, medical-wise?
Yeah, just fantastic training. It was quite trauma-related, obviously. It was everything from sucking chest wounds to putting lines in to splints and fractures and, you know, open fractures, all of that kind of stuff. Just really, it was almost like paramedic training, but obviously a lot more basic.
Would you say you was caring in nature? It sounds very much like you're caring person.
Thanks, Michael.
It really does, you know, everything. And because I know you were a bit away from here as well, it all kind of roads lead to that point.
Yeah.
And we've done loads of stuff, you know, like, so we had the Freedom of Information stuff, which perceived as a bit boring from, really, to start off with, but, you know, pays dividends in the end. And you went to the Hutton Inquiry.
Yeah, after Dr. Kelly, which was a really humbling experience. And then I stayed to do more work on war crimes, tribunals, the Sierra Leone Special Court, International Criminal Court, stuff in with the Milosevic trial. So that was fascinating as well. I got onto the fast stream then, finally. Third time of trying. Okay. Third time, got onto the fast stream. And then I had my first kind of broccoli job, which was finance. You've got to do it, but you don't really enjoy it. But actually, it was good.
Well, like procurement kind of stuff.
It wasn't procurement. It was more in, again, it was more in the armed forces personnel space. It was looking at what people costs could we save in order to enhance other places. So say, save from... you might save on catering to afford more adventurous training. So it was really working with the single services on what they wanted. You know, where did they want to do more? And obviously the more difficult conversation of where we needed to do less. So it was kind of spreadsheet and calculator stuff, but it was only a year.
And you was quite experienced at that point then, was you?
I suppose that was my fourth job.
Yeah, okay.
And then I did the job at PGHQ.
Do you have to, do you have to get a feel for it? Is it like a little, is it a beast? Is it the MOD and defence?
Yeah, it's huge. You know, when you think we've got our own hospitals and transport, and I kind of sometimes think we're all government departments in one, really. But that's what I love about, that's why I really push to get on the fast team, so you can move around it really quite quickly and see really different parts. So I think a lot of the jobs that I've done have been quite different into my latter years.
Is that important then, to see as much as you can?
For me, it is. I like the variety. Yeah. I really like variety, and I think you really grow, but you have to give back. So you can't just suck it all out of the system. You have to be there long enough to contribute back before you then move on.
I mean, you implement a lot.
Yeah.
And I think when your time in Afghanistan was probably, again, testament to
that. Yeah, that was really pivotal for
me. Explain your initial thoughts about going, let me break it into the initial thoughts of going, arriving kind of on a personal level, and then going beyond the wire as well, like going outside the wire and seeing what's going on. And then just like describe what you was implementing when you was there and kind of how it affected you going forward.
So I was based at PGHQ in Northwood rather than out in Afghan. I was embedded with the J3 current ops team down in the bunker. So I was kind of the only civil servant down there with the ops team on the whole floor, actually, and probably one of the only females a lot of the time. But I went out to visit quite a lot, and obviously had a really close relationship with commanders out in Afghanistan. We didn't have an embedded, my opposite number embedded at that time, so it was just me, because it was 2005-06, so prelim ops stuff. And the visits I did out there, you know, my first visit was about 2-3 months after starting, and I think I went out with the Armed Forces Parliamentary Scheme. So it's MPs who you take out to get to understand what the environment is. And you're really conscious about not being a burden on theatre, because they're doing a major operation and they're having to show you around. But it's really important that we understand what it's like out there. So we did everything from... In the first one, it was going up to Mazar-e Sharif. We had meetings in Kabul, meetings with the embassy, obviously meetings with all the troops. And then we flew down to Kandahar, to Helmand. And I was, because I was with either House Commons Defence Committee or Armed Forces Parliamentary Scheme, I got a lot of exposure to things. I got to go around the Role 3 hospital there, which was an amazing facility out in the middle of nowhere. I saw the camp grow from kind of nothing to this huge, you know, boardwalk with all the facilities that we're all familiar are out there. Got to see the detention facility, because I'd been working with the Red Cross to make sure that it, you know, was up to international standards.
So, what, like Taliban and things?
Yeah. No, the one that we had in Helmand. And then I got to go to things like the girls' school. We were handing out basketballs randomly. And I went with my, I'd never forget, I went with my headscarf in, and the head teacher, who was a lady, said, please, can you take your headscarf off, because the girls really want to see your hair and know it's okay that you can show your hair. So that hair thing came in again. So I did get, I got to go to Shuras, got to meet local Afghans all through translators and stuff. But it was just fascinating going to see all these different places.
How long was you in that role?
A year.
And did you take a lot from it?
A lot. And you know, you're working at such a pace, you're working really long hours, you're working over the weekends, but you're working in such a close-knit team with the military. You are just such a close team. You all look after each other. So we had to do all the casualty PT reporting back to main building and stuff. So every time we had a serious injury, very serious injury or killed, we had to write up the circumstances of that and provide press lines and stuff.
Take us back. We're going to that role in depth. What was you doing?
So it was operational policy. So I was looking at the policy for detention or our medical policy.
No, sorry about that. Beg your pardon. So if someone was injured or seriously injured, what was your role within that?
To report that back to ministers and to provide lines to take for the press. Because obviously there's huge interest. We've got embedded journalists out with the theatre. So news comes back really quickly. You obviously know there's a blackout as soon as anything's happened until the family are told. But we would need to tell ministers immediately and just the main building, so head office in London, what had happened and how it happened.
Yeah.
So whether that's, you know, a gunshot or an RTA or an IED, we'd have to explain that.
Was it quite, at that point, six?
Yeah, we had some horrible...
It was getting
horrible,
quite bad, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was that a busy part of your day-to-day?
Yes, yeah, it was really that... unfortunately. Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. Obviously, because we were losing or injuring people. It was a big part of the role. The Nimrod crash was whilst I was there, so... my job was on the ministerial media handling kind of stuff, but you do get exposed to just how much of that was happening out there.
Did you feel responsible? Not for the incidents, but did you feel a personal responsibility to do your job as best you could?
Yeah, and you can't not be not affected by what's going out there, what's going on out there, especially once you've been out a few times and you kind of can really picture it.
Did it take its toll? Pressure.
So I think it was afterwards that it did, because in the time of it you don't really have time to compute, you just get on with the job. It's only afterwards when you come out and you're like, whew. So when I went to the prison service immediately after that job, it's completely different pace and it gives you a chance then to think. And that's I think why I got into running and run the London Marathon. It was a way of me dealing with all of that.
Yeah. Is he still going as a civil servant across?
Yes. Yeah, secondment. So still attached to MED, but you go on a secondment. Okay. Supposed to be for a year, but after a few months, my boss left and they asked me to take over his position. And then after that, I closed that programme down. They said, look, we want to set up a much bigger one. So I did that. And, you know, we had 80 people working on the programme within 3 months. So it was pretty...
What was that? What programme?
It was called Workforce Modernisation. It was changing the structures in prisons. That was really interesting. I got to go out and visit prisons, Balmarsh, Abu Hamza, him in the excise yard, and then, you know, all the way from that to Holloway, where you see the mums and babies unit. So, it was fascinating, but hard work. And then I got a call from my HR director saying, will you go over to DFID, Department for International Development? I'd had 3 miscarriages in the prison service by then, and the doctor was kind of saying, look, you need to think about your working pattern. So I went over to DFID, got pregnant straight away, set up the civil service stabilisation cadre, which is this cadre of 200 civil servants that deployed to hostile areas. I did that within 9 months. I had 6 weeks to go before George was supposed to come out, but I went into, my waters broke 6 weeks beforehand. I was not prepared at all. I was still working. My board papers were due to go on the Monday. This was happening on the Friday. I think I phoned up from hospital on Saturday saying I can't come in on Monday. And then George was an emergency caesarean. He was really quite ill. He got transferred to another hospital, neonatal intensive care unit. And I remember going to call my parents and I had all these missed calls. This Monday morning on my phone. It was from work saying, where are you? You're about to present the paper. And I was like, I've just had a baby. I can't do it. You're going to have to do it for me. Anyway, it all went through and I got to join George several hours later. And he spent a few days in intensive care and he's absolutely fine.
Oh, was that just a few days in NICU?
Just a few days, yeah. NICU. And then I had 15 months off with him, which was amazing.
Yeah, it's the NHS is an extraordinary beast. I've mentioned it on here before, especially my youngest. She did 5 days in NICU after she was born, and it's just a really weird time, is it?
Like, we feel really helpless, and when they're detached to all these wires, and you can't hold them or pick them up or do anything. And because I'd been discharged, we were having to go home and then leave him there,
really?
Which was horrible.
Yeah.
We got
told really early on, before any of this, and before the my first were born, that was just like, you just got to let people get on with it.
They know what they're doing. I know, yeah.
Just let them get on.
But it's like, it's your baby.
Yeah.
And especially after losing some, you're just like, not losing another.
Did you then, so you had a little bit of time.
Yes.
After that, did you what was the next role then?
I worked on the Armed Forces Covenant right when it came in, the very first legislation in 2011. So somebody phoned me up and said, look, I wanted to come back part-time 3 days a week. And this person said, I'm doing it in 4 days, but look, come and have a chat. So I went and spoke to the manager and said, I'm sure I can do this in three, very naively. But I did, and I set up the Armed Forces Covenant in legislation, the principles of no disadvantage for those who have served their families and veterans.
Let's differentiate. So the military covenant was somewhat before.
Yes.
The Armed Forces Covenant is...
It's for all three services.
Yeah.
And there's two basic principles, which you shouldn't be disadvantaged in accessing goods or services if you're serving, have served, or your families. So, you know, we've done things with mobile phone contracts. So if you deploy, you're not penalised in that. It's that an NHS, as we can talk. And then the other principle is around special provision for those who have given the most, such as the injured or bereaved. So those are the new specific pathways that we've got with the NHS for injured people. And then the legislation also makes you have an obligation to report progress back to Parliament every single year, and it's got to be across the UK, so the devolved administrations have got to report progress as well, and then you've got to allow the charity sector to comment on that progress.
What is it then? What is the Armed Forces Covenant? So what was it?
And
it,
yeah, what, so all well, it is those
it's the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not fundamentally the vision's the same.
Yeah, it's about no disadvantage. Yeah. So, and we focus particularly on housing, education, and healthcare to start with. So we know that when Armed Forces families move regularly, they could have got dropped off the NHS waiting list, whereas the Armed Forces Covenant is supposed to make sure that their place is kept relative to the need of others. But we, you know, and there's things like. The things that we've done with private sector, the things that we're doing with local authorities, where they all sign up to making sure that serving people, families and vets aren't disadvantaged and having to move around or being away for long periods of time. So access to schools, places, things like that, making sure that your kids can access if you're moving midterm. We know it's not always perfect because you don't always get the school of your choice, but you do get a school. And I know that's more tricky if you're moving around all the time because you're always not getting a school of your choice. So it's by no means perfect. And we do know that it is patchy across the UK. And that's what we're working really hard to ensure it's consistently delivered across the UK so that people aren't disadvantaged by being in the armed forces, and that we do this special provision.
So I mean, the armed forces coming also, like we said, like veterans, reservists, spouses, partners, dependents as well.
Yeah.
And I've focused a lot, I've been heavily involved from a business side of things with the employment.
Yes.
And seeing, you know, seeing the kind of the strides forward in creating safe working environments for people, like, you know, whether that's little old me doing a talk for a FTSE 100 company about, you know, doing that and understanding not everyone's damaged, very few of us are damaged. You know, we have this national asset.
Exactly.
And it's such, for those that don't understand what it is, just Google Armed Forces Covenant.
Yeah, there's so much information on the website, on our website.
Yeah.
And it is about changing that narrative to say, you know, veterans are a national asset. You employ them, not out of any kind of charitable means, but because they're people you should be employing. They turn up to work on time. They, you know, fantastic at leadership. They get the job done. Work really well as a team. It's all those things you can transfer from the military that make them such good employees. And we do have people that obviously do suffer, whether it's from service or whether it's from things that happened in their childhood. And it's really important that we have specific pathways to help them.
I think one of the great things I've seen working with a few businesses is the spousal side of things as well, like spouses into employment. That and I promise you now, if anyone's listening with a small business or a business who wants to employ somebody, you do very, you know.
Yeah.
And I'll do a little plug, but Recruit for Spouses do an amazing job there.
And the Family Federations are just about to publish a tool next month, online tool for spouses and partners to get into employment. So we're encouraging all the employers to sign up to that tool so that spouses can find jobs in different locations.
What's the, you know, we talked about environments where people can thrive and understand a little bit more, especially with like mental health. What is the, I suppose, the changing landscape in defence with towards kind of mental health?
Yeah. And so whatnot. a couple of jobs later, after the Armed Forces Covenant, I came back to lead it's called the Service Personnel Support Area, or the Armed Forces Support Area now. And that includes all their health, wellbeing, welfare, the Armed Forces Compensation Scheme, and the Covenant. And I think the changing conversation is actually, I think, you know, YZ has something to do with this as well from our work together on Contact and what we've been doing with the Royal Foundation and the Single Services real collaborative efforts to change the conversation on mental health to be about mental fitness and to really push. We pushed out a new strategy a couple of years ago, which is all about promoting good mental health, preventing poor mental health, and detect and treat are the other two pillars. But really pushing the idea that mental health is a spectrum. Everybody has it, just like we have physical health, and we tend to spend a lot more time on our physical health than we do our mental health, but we can be really proactive in how we ensure that we're mentally fit. So we're working with the Royal Foundation to produce some sort of training, consistent training and videos, and doing something really quite different with them. And all of the single services as well have got their own programs on mental fitness. You'll have heard of OpSmart and OpRegain, and I forgot the RAF one, and they're going to kill me.
No, it's only the RAF. Don't worry about it. It's only the RAF.
The Spear program. So there's lots of stuff now going on. So that's kind of really exciting.
We hold people to celebrity status when they're physically fit, when they've got like this big six pack and pecs and all the rest of it. But you look at, well, even yourself, you know, the resilience that's shown, and I think by the sounds of it, but that kind of putting someone almost on a pedestal if you are mentally fit.
Yeah.
Do you know, like, just strive and be creating role models for these people where they're going, yeah, well, this is how I stay on top of my game.
Yeah.
And we should.
So those tools and techniques, I think we just got to talk about it more, talk about how people do stay mentally fit, but it's fine to fluctuate. Your mental fitness doesn't stay at one level. It goes up and down for everybody. And I think, you know, having conversations about that, I think, is really useful for people.
Mm. I think in transition as well, and you see it quite often, people stay at the top of the game when they're in.
Yes.
Because of various reasons, being in a community, being in a physically demanding environment as well.
Yeah.
And then when they leave, that can drop off for various reasons. I think stuff that Glenn's doing and the departments within it, where you're promoting this management of good mental health. Wise is a big advocate for it, amongst others as well.
And I think having those specific pathways, you know, like the transition intervention liaison service with the NHS, so somebody has got mental illness before they leave, we get hold of them 6 months before they leave and put them on a specific transition pathway into the NHS.
Just slow it down. Explain that, because that's...
So if you've got a mental illness, then 6 months before you leave the armed forces, you can either put yourself on or be referred on to something called TILS, which was released last year by the NHS and us in a joint collaboration. And it's where you ensure that there's therefore a seamless transition out of the armed forces, so you get care as you leave, and then as you're a civilian, basically, so that care doesn't drop off. And we're obviously, the NHS obviously evaluating how good that is. But also, if you left some time ago, so this obviously only came in a couple of years ago, you can self-refer or ask your GP to refer into TILS. All the information is on the NHS website. This is NHS England, but Wales, the devolved administrations have their own, and you can go on their websites and have a look. It's really clear how you can get onto that pathway.
So what, Google NHS veteran?
Yeah, it's on the NHS Choices website. There's a whole tab for armed forces, and it includes all the different pathways. It has their veterans prosthetics services on there, has a veterans trauma network on there. It has everything that we do specifically for armed forces and vets. And also families healthcare is all on the website with their referral routes.
Two things, hopefully I get this because I've just thought of it. So I've got a good friend who's left recently who has always diagnosed with PTSD through time in Afghan, and he's been on this podcast. He left and then they contacted him. And
Tills did.
Yeah, and they're trying to push him. Like they're promoting it with him. They've been excellent. Been really. I know some people have not got as good experience as that, but I'm just going off what I've heard.
Yeah.
And so that was a real positive to come, and then to hear the referral.
Yes.
As well, the GP referral or self.
We're working a lot. I think Jonathan Leach, NHS. You know, he's done amazing stuff with GPs and GP surgeries to push out this veteran accredited, so that they're veteran aware. But people have got to register themselves as a veteran when they join a GP practice. You know, if they want the veteran specific pathways, that's the GP won't know. They won't know you're a veteran unless you tell them, and then they can access all the veterans pathways. And it's now in a GP's training, so when they train to become a GP, they now have an armed forces module in there, which which teaches them about the specific things that armed forces may have been through or might make them a bit different from the general population.
Just, I suppose, not a side note. I was going to say a side note. It's not a side note. It's equally as important to pretty much everybody. Are the family kind of narrative, like the wives, the partners, the children as well? Is there any responsibility from the MOD while they're in service?
We have a family strategy and a family's action plan. Our big challenge is communicating with families and letting them know the support that's available. We, through the Armed Forces Covenant Trust Fund, which we might get a chance to talk about, we set up a specific programme for families in stress. So I think it was $4 million over 2 years. People could bid for money to specifically support families. And we're trying to, you know, work in partnership with the family federations on what more we can do.
Okay, yeah. And these, we've addressed it on here, especially with children. And look, we've addressed it today, you know, the impact of... I suppose, experiences as children, especially if it's chaotic and, and like I said, traumatic, and the effects growing up into adult. And obviously we've had a period of time in the military where it's been, you could say, chaotic and traumatic and everything in between. And it's not going to be interesting, but I'm concerned that the children side of things... I just don't want it to be left.
I know what you mean. We're working with King's and other academic institutions to research specifically the effect of children on deployments, on having parents with PTSD, and those then drive our policies. So we work really closely with academia, and I think I mentioned to you... we went out to Invictus last year at Sydney, and the first week before the competitors are there is all the clinicians and policymakers coming from all of those nations to share what they do. And from that, we got some really good practice on family strategy, the veteran strategy, a transition process. And it's really enabled us to shape learning from international best practice. We work really closely with academia. You know, Nicola and I presented together at those conferences saying this is the evidence and this is how it shapes the policy.
Nicola Fia.
And I know you've had Simon on here.
I know Nicola fairly well. Can we talk about that then for a sec? So the link between the MOD, because there's a clear distinction between the MOD, the state, the private public sector, and the third sector, so the charity. Is there a better integration now? It sounds very much there is. Better integration between the MOD and charities.
I think the charities would think that too. I know particularly when I was a head of service personnel support, I really reinvigorated our Service Charities Partnership Board. So that's a board where we have the chief execs of people like Help for Heroes and BLESMA and British Legion and COBSIO and SAFA, Combat Stress.
The bigger charities.
Yeah, it does tend to be the bigger ones and the Single Service Benevolent Funds. And we sit down and say, okay, what is the evidence suggesting? What is MOD doing about it? How can the charity sector top up what the state provide, and how can we work together? So, for example, we saw that there was a particular problem with early service leavers struggling once they left, because probably they haven't been in the armed forces long enough to learn some of the key skills that make you successful on the outside. So we worked with SAFA to set up a mentoring scheme for those early service leavers. It was successful, so we've now brought that into defence, and we now pay and deliver that defence transition service for all people now, not just early service leavers, but anybody who's seen as needing just an extra hand, really, as they transition out. We work with Combat Stress, obviously. They deliver our 24-hour helpline for serving people. I pay for that, but they deliver that for me. And I think the work that we do with British Legion and Help for Heroes in the recovery space and much wider is probably quite well known. So it's definitely a partnership. It's right that they continue to pressure us to do more and tell us where we're not doing enough. Help for Heroes, for example, helped shape the work on the Integrated Care Pathway for Veterans, which is a new way of pooling all the different funding together from the NHS and local authorities and clinical commissioning groups. We've been working on that for some time with the NHS leading it, with Surgeon General's area and MOD helping. But as the result of a specific case that I worked on last year, MOD was able to enhance that for our most significantly injured, those who require 24-hour care, so that they have an extra top-up of up to £24,000 a year to do the kind of life-enhancing stuff. So if you need 24-hour care, the NHS will pay, or their commissioning group will pay for your carer. But if you want to go on holiday, they're not going to pay for the carer to go on holiday. So it's being able to use that top-up funding to pay for that. So as an individual, you get your guaranteed income payment, you get your compensation, so you pay for your own holiday. But if it costs you extra to go because you're requiring 24-hour nursing care, then this fund allows you to do that. And just personal preferences allows you to top up how much physical training you might get, or how much kind of speech and language therapy you might get. So some
it's
of it is
veteran as well.
This is all veterans.
Where does that get accessed?
Called the Integrated Care Pathway for Veterans. So we know the most significantly injured ones that require 24-hour care. So there's a number of people, really small number, on the top-up scheme, which is what MOD pay that top-up bit. But all veterans with ongoing healthcare needs can now access this Integrated Care Pathway for Veterans. Again, I know we haven't got much time, so just Google it.
Oh, no,
people are interested in it. And it's just about giving that person more choice about where they access their health and how they access their healthcare.
The people you're referring to, especially these guys that really suffered badly and will need this care for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
It can be very emotive, seeing videos and stuff like that. But you personally, I know, and you don't need to go into it too much. Or you don't need to go into it at all. I'll just tell everyone what you do. But very personal, get involved with these people to make it better. Things don't happen overnight. It takes time.
Yeah.
We are going in the right direction with the Armed Forces Compensation Scheme.
Yeah.
Again, learnt from, you're improving as we go along. Payments have jumped hugely as of last. Is it April last year?
April last year. It moved to $650, the top tariff. Yeah. And you obviously get your guaranteed income payment as well.
And
more parity with mental illness as well.
Go on.
So there's higher rate now for the worst kind of mental ill health. And we have an independent body that advises us on how much you should get for all of these these injuries. It's called IMEG, the Independent Medical Expert Group. And one thing that we are looking at is the issue around interim awards. So people get an interim award without getting their final payout, and we need to look at how long that's lasting and have we got that right, because I'm kind of hearing from talking to people that we haven't. So we need to work on how we can improve that.
Mm. I think one of the concerns from me as an employer, just purely an employer, nothing to do with being friends with people that are going through this, is the fact that it was almost beneficial if you're suffering from things like PTSD, that it's to stay a bit shit.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to put words in your mouth. I'm not going to ask you to answer that question. I think it's for another time.
Yeah.
But something certainly does need to happen with that, and we should be promoting growth and not staying ill to get a higher payment,
yeah.
And especially with people who've been discharged and they're receiving pensions because of it.
Yeah.
Especially that direct effect of conflict. I think that needs to be.
We need to look at that.
Just something that I know that people want to know about. And I am interested about, and it's there's the compensation scheme that you're responsible for.
Yeah.
Why do we see, and it infuriates me when I see someone who's drunk in a bar, some squaddy or RAF, whatever, they have an accident and then they sue the MOD. Is that anything to do with this?
It's not. It's a completely different scheme and it's run by a completely different team. So I'm not as familiar with that, but I think it's all about whether MOD was negligent at any point. So instead of, so it's around negligence claims where you sue your employer rather than the Armed Forces Compensation Scheme is a no-fault scheme. So mine's all about injury whilst you're on duty. That other scheme is more about people taking us to court, is my understanding. I do need to work closer with that team. So we're looking at some more joint work as we take forward new proposals.
Okay, so that's interesting. So compensation scheme is, say that again, what was the
The Armed Forces Compensation Scheme is a no-fault scheme, which means we pay out for injuries whilst you're on duty, whereas the other scheme is, I think if there's some negligence by the department, that's my understanding.
Look, we've gone through the compensation scheme. You deal with people on a almost week, you know, weekly basis, maybe a day-to-day basis, who've been impacted. How is the treatment of wounded in service improved over this last kind of 15, 16 years?
So I think we learned hugely, didn't we, from Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's had a real translation to how we recover people in their civilian world as well. I'm about to, later this month, kick off a review, though, into the defence recovery capability, because, as you said, it has kind of drawn up from 15 years of experience really quite quickly. And I think now's the time to just say, have we got it right? Have we got all the links right? And I don't know the answers to that yet. We need to work really closely with Surgeon General Zera, who are responsible for the clinical practice that goes on. Mine is more the policy side. So we'll have to wait until that review comes out. But I think in terms of how people go through that pathway, we've learnt a lot of lessons.
I think it transfers over into the NHS as well. You know, we've had people on the podcast that we've mentioned that, and that the improvements that's seen in recovery and treatment, especially that initial treatment as well. You mentioned bigger charities or the MOD working with larger charities. Yeah. We've also mentioned the Armed Forces Covenant Fund.
Yes.
And that's a real opportunity for smaller organisations, community interest companies and smaller charities to get some kind of funding, to get a leg up, to get some support from the MOD.
Yes.
You're kind of responsible,
is that
right?
I'm chair of trustees for that. Yeah, so it was an internal team within my team in defence, but I brought in professionals from the lottery and people who'd worked on the London Bomb Grant programme, so grant-making professionals, and I created an independent charity outside of the MOD to run it so they could use really, you know, fantastic grant making IT systems, which you can't use in MOT because of our IT, who just had the expertise to build these grant programs, evaluate them properly. And I, you know, really proud of what they've achieved in the last year. So I set that up in April last year. So
and that's from the 10 million
year.
That was.
Yeah, so we get 10 million of MOD funding every year, ring fenced in MOD's budget.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then this year, the Chancellor gave us an extra £10 million specifically for veterans' mental health programs. And that's where we're encouraging veterans designed, veterans led, smaller charities to work locally at a local level with veterans. We've had really good success from breakfast clubs, activity clubs, you know, all the arts and as well as sporting stuff. So we do all of that. And then we were given an extra £3 million to help building facilities, particularly, I think, British Legion clubs or other similar clubs to get up to a decent standard, you know, so people want to go and use them as drop-in centres, or we have a, you know, an isolation, social isolation problem with perhaps some of our older veterans. So it's about how we draw them into these clubs so that they form that community again. So it's a, and again, please Google it. There's programmes that are live at the moment. We've got a board meeting on Friday where we're going through 200 odd grant applications for our local delivery programme. So we've done things like families in stress. We've done their veterans' mental health. We've done all sorts of kind of local delivery, community integration, loads of projects there. And we evaluate them all. So we've got a really good evaluation tool. So we know what works. And some of the things that we funded are things like the Vets Gateway, which should be our one-stop shop for where veterans go to seek help on everything from employment to health issues. It's all on the website, call centre, live chat. We need to keep developing that. And the British Legion now run that in consortium with some other charity partners. But we that came out of the Covenant Trust Fund. And we've created this thing called the Map of Need, with academia, to look at where are veterans living in the UK, what kind of services are they accessing. It's for families as well, so veterans and families, and that helps us then target where we spend the fund. So some really groundbreaking work coming out of that fund.
Do you have to be do you need like a professional grant writer to apply for this?
No,
stuff?
You shouldn't do. And we're trying to make it as easy as possible.
Yeah.
And we're always taking feedback on the forms. Are they too complicated? Are they too long? But you've got to balance that between we need to know enough information that you're going to spend this money in the right way, that you're not going to go on holiday with it, that what you're going to do is going to do no harm rather than, you know, that's quite an interesting, that's So we do need to collect certain information for propriety and ethics reasons and just good governance.
Can you start from afresh if you've got a new idea, or is it something
yes.
that's been going on?
No, start from afresh. But we do look at how you're going to sustain yourself then after this grant has run out. So we
that's
don't.
That's interesting. Yeah.
But hopefully, so what this new evaluation tool will do is help you build the business case to get evidence from elsewhere. So we could pump prime your funding and use our funding to test your concept. And if it's really successful, use our tool to evaluate it, and then that helps you build up a business case to get funding from elsewhere.
Yeah, I know there's a few. I know a few people that are going through that the process at the moment, and
yeah.
they're amazing little CICs and small charities that
yeah.
are going to be able to do something amazing with that
brilliant.
Little bit of injection.
Yeah, brilliant.
And then I know because I've had I wouldn't have said mentoring, but I've like talked through some of the projects, and by the end of it, there is a proper business model, a self-sufficient
yes.
business model
yep.
of growth, actually, a
brilliant.
Growth model, not but sometimes you need that capital, and,
yes.
and I think that Covenant Fund is
can do a lot of
yeah
good.
It can do so much for so many people,
yeah.
I think
and going to visit the projects
yeah.
and seeing what it I mean, we put some money into the Sheffield trials this year, so we went up to Sheffield, and obviously we saw
yeah.
you there. But seeing what some of that money funded, the indoor arena, and what happened at the indoor arena was just brilliant.
But why is it so important working with the military community for you?
I suppose we've been doing it a little while now. it's one of the most important things that the country can do is defend our country, our way of living, and protect our interests overseas.
But for you on a personal level, come on, like the people you...
So I love working with the people that I do, you know. It's,
yeah, yeah.
You meet some incredible people and some incredible people supporting other incredible people. So it's because of what we do, I think, what defence does and what the people do in order to deliver that.
Mm. I get from you every time I speak to you and those that I know who work with you indirectly, that there's a feeling of, like I said, of looking after people and doing the right thing for a lot of people as well. Helen, thanks so much, and we will leave it there.